This is going to be a somewhat disorganized presentation, but I don't apologize. Because, dear audience, the fact that you have to suffer it is due to your bad karma. You must have done something terrible in a past life that you have to put up with this, but that's your fault, I'm afraid. It's slightly disorganized because I decided, since it concerns, at heart, the influence of the Buddhist canon in China, this massive achievement in intercultural communication, no great clash of civilization here. It's a body of materials about 50 times the size of the Christian Bible, translating South Asian languages into East Asian languages, which isn't easy. It took about 1,000 years. But then what? What happens to translations? So I thought I would try out this particular presentation at the University, Chinese University of Hong Kong, the translation department. And so I introduced the topic of Jainism as known to the Chinese. And there is a professor there, Professor Chan Man Sing, who's in the best tradition of Hong Kong erudition. And at the end of my presentation, he says, yes, my grandmother used to talk in Cantonese about Jainism. It was a synonym for utter nonsense, which was news to me. But the point I was trying to make, until so disconcerted, was that the modern word for Jainism, Qina Jiao, is something that would appear to derive from... ultimately, perhaps from Western Indology, it's not part of the Chinese tradition. It's like the modern word for Judaism, for example, which doesn't go back into Chinese history. So this news was a bit alarming. There does seem to have been a small Jain community in East Asia, possibly for much of the 20th century. Its history is extremely obscure as yet, but it's quite possible, for example, that in Hong Kong, Cantonese found the restrictions on the Jain way of life rather peculiar from their point of view, especially in things like, you know, food taboos and so forth. And I think it's that lies behind his grandmother's use of the term rather than any profound doctrinal knowledge. But of course, there was a knowledge of not of Jainism using the modern word, but of the term usually used was Nyingranta, which is part of the, which means an ascetic. It's part of the terms and titles usually used by Mahavira, the Jain equivalent of the Buddha, the Shakyamuni Buddha, the person who occupies the same kind of foundational role. And his followers tended to attract this term, ascetic Nyingranta, in the representations of them in Buddhist texts. I think we'll just pass over the entire history of Jainism as a modern word and cut to the chase. Of course, in the Buddhist scriptures, especially the earliest layer that are equivalent to the texts we have from South Asia in Pali, they are an opposition rather like the Pharisees in the New Testament. They're the, they're brand X. They're the bunch of people who think they're as good as us, but they're not. They're hypocrites, they're liars, they are formalists, you know, they pretend to be religious, but they're not. And their role really in the earliest Buddhist texts is to be the opposition. And of course, in such literature, in any religious literature, the role of the opposition is A, to oppose, usually by unfair means, and B, to be defeated spectacularly. So this is what tends to happen to Jains in this layer of translated materials. Now, when you get the rise of more liberal sentiment, shall we say, in the Buddhism that we call Mahayana, then this rather invidious role is toned down a bit. They're just members of the audience. They're probably sitting next to, what are called Hinayana types. You know, they're just all maybe they're in the back row or somewhere, but they're just there as part of the audience of a Buddha or the Buddha preaching. They're mentioned in passing in very well-known sutras like the Lotus or the Vimalakirti that were known to most people who had any contact with the Buddhist tradition in East Asia. But not much is said about them. But obviously these texts attract commentary, and there's generally some kind of explanation. Who are these Nirgrantas? They're ascetics, is usually the kind of gloss that is put on them. But of course, in the, shall we say, a third tier of translated literature, the sort of scholarly treatises of Indian Buddhism, you do find more information. They're Nirgrantas, they're wrong because they believe this, that, and the other. But they tend, of course, to be part of, I suppose you would call this, in terms of Europe, heresiography. These people are wrong because of this, and they're wrong because of that, and the others are wrong because of something else. So you get a quick sort of snapshot of, half a dozen bad ideas from half a dozen heretical thinkers. You would have to piece together all this information quite carefully from different sources to come up with any integrated image of what Jainism was all about. And of course, nobody did. Why should they? So what you get then is scattered references that, apart from their hypocrisy, sometimes you get references to their asceticism. For example, Eric Green, who's was a colleague in Britain but has now got a chair in Buddhist studies at Yale, has recently published a very interesting piece on the establishment of Buddhist vegetarianism in China. And he makes the interesting point that this is a distinctively Chinese phenomenon. It does not reflect a Buddhist vegetarianism of India. It seems to be a construct that is being used in China to differentiate the Buddhist tradition from others within that situation. And it was something that in the early 6th century in South China was enforced by imperial decree. And at this point, you do actually see some of the resistance, the Buddhist clergy who actually knew their own doctrines better than the emperor, coming up and saying, oh, if you think we're going to go around not wearing leather sandals and not eating meat, that's what Nirgrantas do. You know, that's just too much asceticism for a Buddhist, really. And the emperor ignored them, of course. He's the emperor. But you do find the name comes up in polemical contexts in China, and it's obviously recognized. It's not that there is zero knowledge. And you find other indications that stories about Nirgrantas are recognized. You can see them in frescoes at Dunhuang. The stories themselves seem to have been familiar. Of course, we don't find any actual Jain doctrines coming through, no text giving an honest appraisal of what they are, but we wouldn't really expect that. There is one text which is spoken, as it were, through the person of a learned Jain, but it turns out he's actually a bodhisattva in disguise, as it were, which happens quite a bit, you know, that you can never tell where a bodhisattva is going to turn up. So this can legitimate all kinds of situations. And of course, the account given of Jain doctrine there, although it does touch on some interesting questions like state violence and so forth, again, you can't take it as a genuine representation of Jainism. rather, the as you can see, my concern is not really with India. I know very little about India, or indeed contacts with India. What fascinates me is the nature of the transmission of knowledge in China, to some extent just the technology, but also the intellectual constructions that allow for the transmission, the diffusion of knowledge in China. And if you look at the way that such information as there was about Jainism gets sustained or diffused, then it's an interesting picture. For example, you know, the very early layer of information about Jainism that comes right at the beginning of Buddhism, almost in the 3rd century CE, in which, you know, the Buddha says there are basically three attitudes you can have towards a Buddhist ritual. You can just go along with it, like some people do. You can pretend that you're engaging in it like Jains do, or you can be sincerely committed like a real Buddhist is. This kind of characterization gets taken up, you know, in the section how to do a ritual, and it's repeated in encyclopedias, and it's picked up even in the 17th century by one of the great leaders of Chinese Buddhism at this time in his little handbook of how to do rituals at home. Because, of course, in later imperial Buddhism, the switch is very much away from the monastery to the believer in the household, and it's his, it's always his, you know, little community of believers. How do you organize that? And the basic principles, you know, you mustn't be like a giant when you do your ritual, that goes right the way through. And this particular set of regulations is revised in 1824, for example. And still, you're told, don't behave like a giant. Oh, no. That's one way in which knowledge of Jainism is transmitted. If you try and look at what one would take to be the great golden age of Buddhist belief in China, the age of Xuanzang and so forth, then does the word Nirgranta get bandied around in literature? Not really very much. I just found one text where it turns up, and it's rather surprising. It's in a Taoist encyclopedia, but it's in an excerpt from a Taoist scripture. And in this Taoist scripture, a Taoist divinity is preaching, and he's preaching to a massive audience in some Taoist heaven. And in the back row, it says there are Nirgranthas. Now, my German colleague, who summarized this encyclopedia in German, said, I do not know what this word is. And of course, you know, for a Taoist divinity to have Jains in the back row is kind of a bit bizarre, but you have to see that at this point, Taoists were so impressed by the popularity of Buddhist sutras that they tend to adapt them more or less wholesale into the scriptures of their own religion. So if the Buddha is preaching to Jains, then Taoists preach to Jains as well. But that's just one slightly unusual example. Otherwise, you do find occasionally a poet who's had a Buddhist education will mention a Nirgranta when referring to Buddhist stories about, you know, the conversion of Nirgranthas, if the poetry is on a Buddhist theme. Or, for example, I think it's in the 16th or 17th century, late 16th or early 17th century, there is a poet who's clearly quite educated in Buddhism who meets a very ascetic monk, and he says his shape is like a swan or like a Nirgranta. He's, you know, he's otherwise kind of bony sort of and unusual looking. So it's not that in later literature the term doesn't appear. But for the most part, it's just not there. Does this mean there's a complete failure of communication, that the Buddhist translations just gathered dust, as it were? Nobody read them. outside, of course, the monasteries where these things were stored. Well, yes and no, because there is a term, which is a broader term than the Neogranda, which does establish itself, and this is the term in Chinese, Wai Dao, heretic, which is a broader classification in Buddhism, in Chinese translation, for heretics as a group. And of course, the founder of Jainism, Mahavira, was amongst the six key heretics of Buddhist tradition. And so, in fact, that's the reason why he's in the Vimalakirti, you know, because the six great heretics are mentioned. But Chinese seem to have found much more amusing the fact that, as well as six great heretics, there are actually, in toto, about 96 heresies, which is seems to be an entertaining thought, at least to Taoists, because in some Taoist texts you find a list of them, and they're all, as it were, invented. You know, you can imagine it's a rainy afternoon in the Taoist monastery, and they've been at the magic mushrooms, and they're all a bit sort of laid back, and you know, they said, let's think of 96 silly names for heresies, and how about Baoism and Dudism, Dudism is good, but how about Waoism, you know? And so they seem to have spent a lot of time inventing funny names for heresies, except their imagination flagged eventually, and they had to throw in Manichaeanism and Christianity just to make up the numbers, which makes it a very interesting source indeed. So we know from this kind of information that the notion of a huge number of heresies in India did travel beyond the Buddhist community itself. And one finds, for example, it's the 13th century, effectively, one literary critic has a very extended metaphor about different types of poetry. And which can be related to different types of Zen, for example. And he said, of course, there's poetry, which is just Wai Dao, which is just heretical. It doesn't make sense except in his extended metaphor. He's not saying the poetry is heretical in any doctrinal sense. He's just saying it has these qualities of presumably being relative rubbish compared with what he thought was the good stuff. But this kind of usage, again, does persist way into the 17th century, at least, as far as I've been able to trace it. So this broader term does have a history and does seem to have impressed people. And indeed does seem to have passed into the language in general. I think it's actually quite a useful term because, for example, there are Chinese terms for heresy and heterodoxy, xie dao, for example, but they tend to have political overtones, you know, that if you complain to your dean that some academic rival of yours believes in a heterodox way, xie dao, then the dean will say, oh, we'll have to inform the authorities. But if you say that that guy, he's just a Wai Dao, the dean will say, academic freedom, you know, you can believe whatever you want, because it's a term that does not have political overtones, and that's actually something quite useful in saying that you disagree with somebody, but it's just, as it were, a doctrinal disagreement. So this usage is established. You do find encyclopedias will occasionally mention more specifically in their lists of things Neogranthas, you know, Jains specifically, but they don't go into any detail. I think encyclopedias are very interesting. A lot has been written about Chinese encyclopedias, and some of it is nonsense. They do actually show, you know, the structures of knowledge and how knowledge was organized. And within these are Buddhist encyclopedias only, which we know, for example, were in the Imperial Library in the 18th century. You do find the excerpts about Neo Grant as a hypocrite do get picked up, whether the emperor ever looked at them or not, who knows. You got any idea whether the emperor actually went into his library any time and passed the time of day? He mainly seems to have been writing rubbish poetry himself incessantly. But he was studying Sanskrit, for example, with a Tibetan Lama. You know, that's which Professor Mosca has gone into some detail in this, surprisingly, you know, revealed a side of the Manchu emperors that they didn't generally advertise to their Chinese subjects. But whether he actually got, you know, learned to, he sort of revised his knowledge of Jainism, I rather doubt. And when you look at the way in which the sort of category heretic is used within Chinese Buddhist encyclopedias, they tend to be light on the details, you know. They will, for example, they will pick up the story of there are three kinds of ritual, attitudes to ritual, and then they will not use the specific word Neogranta. They will just use a broader term, Wai Dao, heretic. So that's just, as it were, a very quick survey of how knowledge of Jainism was transmitted in a very limited way within China. There are one or two things to be said about peripheral matters that might impinge on this. As I said, I don't know when a Jain community actually came into being in China. I imagine it's in the treaty ports and places like Hong Kong in the 19th century. Perhaps we might hear a bit more about this later. There's nothing to indicate that visitors from, certainly in late imperial China, were anything more than uncommon. And that's why they tend to be described when they do show up. Certainly overland. I mean, coastal communications through coastal trading ports is possibly another matter. So perhaps it's no surprise that there's so little knowledge of Jainism that seems to be alive, as it were. It's brought in, but it's perpetuated in certain ways, but it doesn't seem to stimulate any further inquiries. But then if you've never met a Jain, why should you bother? There is no sign that there are even Jains in contiguous territories. There is one reference which cannot be discounted. I just thought it might be a textual error, but it clearly isn't, which says that there were Jains in the middle of Vietnam in the 5th century. But I think you have to take that with a bit of a pinch of salt, because when Chinese travelers observe non-Chinese religion, they tend to use analogies in a slightly... I won't say haphazard, because it's not entirely haphazard. What they want to say is that these people are religious, but they're not Buddhists. And so if there is an organized religion which they don't recognize, and they know it's not Buddhist, Jain is one option. Taoist is another option. You get these rather odd descriptions of Cambodia that suggest that it's full of Taoist priests, going on until 13th century, for example. I'm sure there were no Taoist priests in Cambodia as such. What the traveller means is these people have the same function in Cambodian society as Taoists have with regard to Buddhists in China. So I think we have to discount this information. Xuanzang does actually use this kind of analogy in a very entertaining way. You'll know the passage, won't you? I think they're Shvetambara Jains. They're white-clad heretics. So he says, there are these white-clad heretics. They have images just like we have in Buddhism, blah, 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 quite a bit. And then he says, images of their celestial master. Now, this could be just his translation of something like Devaguru or something, which is a conceivable term for a Jain master. But it just so coincides that with a very common term for a leader of Taoism in China, and indeed in a form of Taoism that the emperor to whom he's writing, in effect, as you have shown, would have been well aware of. But he's tactful enough not to labour the point, but he has just inserted an insinuation that there are heretics in India who are just like Taoists in China, who are, of course, heretics. But he can't say that, can he, to his emperor? So in this one instance, I think you can find a description of Jainism that is being used in a slightly roundabout way to imply a critique of Chinese society. But for the most part, as I've said, knowledge just seems to sit in the text. It can get diffused through the Buddhist tradition, through encyclopedias, handbooks, and so forth, but it doesn't seem to trigger anything else. Knowledge of the existence of heresy doesn't really seem to trigger any reflections in China either until the beginning of the 20th century, when intellectual leaders who were in touch with now with India and with Japan start to say, oh, you can't really understand Buddhism actually unless you see its non-Buddhist context in India. But that doesn't happen before the onset of modernity. To some extent, however, that does happen in Japan, and we've seen how some of the images you've seen actually come from Japan today. And I think the relationship between Japan and India is slightly different from the relationship between China and India. I know the conference is not about that, but that, as it were, is sort of my final caveat to you describing Jainism as having no consequence within the Chinese tradition. I think you have to look at heresy more broadly, but again, the notion of heresy may also have played more of a part in, say, 18th century Japan than it ever did in China, for reasons which are to do with a very large range of circumstances we need not go into today. Thank you.